Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, coverage of the recent state visit from Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto didn't avoid mention of violence in Mexico, including the disappearance of 43 student teachers in September. But the explanations of that violence and of the U.S. relationship to it hid more than they revealed. We'll talk with Laura Carlson from the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy about the desaparecidos and the nature of violence in Mexico. Also on the show, before the movie even opened, there were high-profile criticisms of Selma, particularly around the well-received film's depiction of Lyndon Johnson. FAIR's own Jim Narikas will join us to discuss what those criticisms say, not so much about the film as about the critics. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. As media coverage continues of the January 7th attacks in Paris, killing 17, including 12 staff members of French magazine Charlie Hebdo, things have taken some sadly predictable turns. Meet the Press previewed its January 11th episode with talk of how attacks in the name of Islam raise questions about how religion encourages some people to choose violence. While Face the Nation's setup involved, quote, one of the gravest challenges of our day, preventing Westerners from traveling to the Middle East, training with terror groups, and bringing their terror home, close quote. It implies no diminishment of the significance of the Paris attacks to note that elite media did not ask similar questions 3 years ago, when Norwegian Anders Breivik killed 77 people, mostly teenagers, to call attention to his view that Muslim immigration was destroying Europe. In fact, neither Face the Nation nor Meet the Press had a single word to say on the slaughter. It's corporate media's choice to elevate nonsense, like the Fox News segment in which discredited expert Stephen Emerson described Birmingham, England, as under Sharia law, just one of the European cities he claimed that is, quote, totally Muslim, where non-Muslims just simply don't go in, close quote. And it's a choice to entertain so much lofty discourse about upholding Western values of liberal democracy, to take a phrase from the New York Times, at the same moment as this country marks 13 years of maintaining a prison camp in Guantanamo Bay for the express purpose of holding people indefinitely without charge or trial. You'd hope journalists would find a little more irony, if not outrage, in reporting denunciations of assaults on free expression coming from leaders like David Cameron and Barack Obama, who have led fierce attacks on their own citizens' freedom to communicate and associate, and who seem set to respond to the Paris attacks with further predations. But then, part of the reason U.S. media consumers aren't confronted with this country's contradictions is that these aren't even seen as such in the corporate press. In TV news coverage of the recent Senate report detailing torture carried out by the CIA, a new FAIR study found that torture supporters outnumbered critics of torture nearly 2-1. Well, while media are talking about cultural taboos, they're still busy observing some corporate ones. One hardy perennial is the persistent refusal to acknowledge a key element of high health care costs in this country: patent protection for drugs. Economist Dean Baker spotted the latest example, a January 14th New York Times op-ed headlined "Why Drugs Cost So Much," that makes no mention of the government-granted monopolies that allow companies to charge prices several hundred or even several thousand percent above the free market price. In a free market, as Baker has pointed out for years, most drugs would sell for $5 to $10 per prescription. But the Times column tells readers the cost culprit is, quote, a mix of laws that force insurers to include essentially all expensive drugs in their policies and a philosophy that demands that every new healthcare product be available to everyone, no matter how little it helps or how much it costs, close quote. Well, there are alternative ways to fund research, like direct support from government, that can't get arrested in the corporate press, except to be denounced as government intervention. Though, of course, it's the granting of a monopoly that represents the intervention, and not incidentally serves as the spur for companies to misrepresent their drugs' effectiveness and safety. A serious inquiry into why drugs cost so much, in other words, would say less about big philosophy and more about big pharma. Finally, it's clear that some outlets consider conflict of interest rules suggestions, and mild ones at that. A recent example, courtesy of NBC Nightly News, the January 6th program featured special anchor Maria Shriver reporting on the new movie Still Alice, from which, as an executive producer, she stands to gain some money. She thinks it's terrific, by the way. The newscast took the hide-in-plain-sight route, with host Brian Williams' intro describing the film, which deals with Alzheimer's disease, as, quote, a passion project for one of its producers, close quote. When called on the self-dealing segment by The Washington Post's Paul Farhi, a Shriver representative similarly noted that she plans to donate her gains to charity. All of which is fine. It's just that serious news shows don't traditionally have correspondents use Showtime to promote outside financial projects, no matter how high-minded. That sounds more like, well, morning TV, like the Today Show, Maria Shriver's usual gig, where she'd promoted her movie the day before. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Days after Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto's Washington meeting with Barack Obama, the Arizona Republic was fuming. Peña Nieto didn't deserve red carpet treatment, the Republic editorialized, because of Mexico's bad human rights record, including the disappearing of 43 student teachers in September. But the real outrage for the paper was that an aide to Peña Nieto had the nerve to suggest that the U.S. had problems too, mentioning Ferguson. Quote, Mexico has notoriously corrupt and ineffective law enforcement. The United States has, at worst, a few rogue officers, close quote. Well, that's the corporate press for you. When you see criticism of an official ally, it often comes with a big dose of delusion about U.S. practice and policy. It's an especially unhelpful approach for understanding violence in Mexico and its relationship to the United States. Joining us now to discuss these issues is Laura Carlson of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. She joins us by phone from Mexico City. Welcome back to Counterspin, Laura Carlson.
Well, thank you very much, Tanin.
Well, Peña Nieto came to Washington to, as NBC News put it, tout his economic reforms, such as the opening of Mexico's oil and gas industry to private investment. These are efforts that NBC said have been overshadowed by the violence against 43 students. Those from the Ayotzinapa school in Iguala disappeared on September 26th. The Washington Post reported that, quote, Obama said the fate of the missing 43 students was a tragedy and promised to support the Mexican government in its fight against drug cartels and drug violence, close quote. But particularly in light of investigations suggesting at least passive or even active involvement of federal officials in the disappearances, I wonder, is the Peña Nieto government versus drug cartels and violence really the appropriate frame for understanding the current situation?
I think that's exactly the question. When we saw Obama's statement that he was going to help the Mexican government overcome this violence, many of us were frankly flabbergasted because it's become so clear, particularly in the last couple of months, not just with the case of Ayotzinapa, but also with several other cases, especially Tlatlaya, where the army has been found to have executed a number of youth thought to be part of a gang, that the Mexican government is the violence, that it's part of the problem and certainly not part of the solution, at least in broad parts of the country. I think that it showed what was already planned from the beginning with this meeting, that Obama was going to give Peña Nieto a pat on the back in order to carry through with these reforms, which are reforms that the economic elite and the U.S. government have been pressuring for a long time. But what it also showed on the face of it was just an incredible ignorance about the real dynamics of the violence in Mexico and the degree of involvement of the government and the need to actually be supporting the citizenry in overcoming this violence and corruption of which the government is a big part.
What can we say about the involvement, since the story up till now has been local politicians, local drug cartels in Guerrero? What is there to say about the involvement or degree of involvement of federal officials there?
Well, first of all, of course, local officials are part of government, and they're part of government that forms a chain from the three levels, municipal, state, to federal, with interlinking responsibilities. In this case in particular, the moment that the federal government decided to come out with the hypothesis, the theory that it was the mayor who ordered these attacks and who set the local police out to carry out the attacks, and the fact that the local police carried out the attacks is not under discussion at all. It's a known fact. Then you have to ask yourselves, why did they, in a month's time after this event, discover that this local mayor was so corrupt, and did they not have reason to think so before? And of course they did. And so you have significant federal responsibility in the sense that this local mayor had not only been accused of links to organized crime, but there was a formal complaint for murder that he personally executed a grassroots leader a year ago in 2013, and the federal attorney general's office never even looked into it. That's pretty typical here in Mexico, and a lot of people believe that it's just part of a dysfunctional system. But you have to ask yourself about why that system is so dysfunctional. I mean, if you were in the Attorney General's office and you see a report like that coming in, where not only is there homicide at stake, but it's a homicide that reportedly has been committed by an acting mayor, what would it be that would cause you to completely ignore it? And that's when we begin to ask questions about the complicity of the federal government with many of these corrupt mayors and the kinds of shady businesses that government officials might be involved in.
This is why protesters, as I've seen you note, are referring to a crime of the state. In other words, they're not talking as much as about corruption, although corruption is its own issue. But a state violence is not the same as a few corrupt officials.
They also believe that this crime was actually planned to strike a blow directly against this particular group of students. We're talking about Rural Teachers College outside of Iguala in Guerrero. They have been around since about 1926 as a result of the revolution. And the school curriculum has always incorporated revolutionary ideals of social justice. The students have always been very active. They come from poor indigenous families, so they're active both as students as well as in many of their communities. They are foremost in protests that have to do with peasant farmer rights and with teachers' rights. And in fact, they were getting ready to go to a demonstration in downtown Mexico City against the 1968 massacre, which has become emblematic of the student movement and of repression here in Mexico when this attack was carried out. So they are saying that this was politically motivated to silence a group that's been particularly vocal in terms of resisting many of those same economic reforms that you mentioned before that include the oil privatization, and they also include a broad reform of the education system, which strips away teachers' rights, and in their case in particular makes it more difficult that coming out of their training they would be able to work in their own communities and find jobs. So they say that there's a political motivation to this crime. And recently, quite a bit of evidence has come out that the federal police and the army, who were both very close by at the time of the attacks, which didn't happen in just a few seconds. We're talking about a series of attacks against five busloads in different places between the night of the 26th of September and the dawn of 27th of September, the police and the army were right there. The army in particular showed up at a hospital when the wounded were taken to the hospital and refused to let students into a private clinic to be treated. And so it actually blocked and harassed the students when they were already wounded, when they had already stood by and known that this attack was going on. And the federal police at least did the same. There's some evidence or some lines of investigation that the federal police was more actively involved in the attacks on the students. So when you put all this together, you see something that goes beyond that one bad apple theory of the town mayor and looks much more like something that involved many forces that went all the way up to the federal level that at least has involved a cover-up, if not more active participation.
It runs so completely in counter to the line that we are seeing here in the press that speaks of the weak state in Mexico. And Greg Grandin in The Nation called that a catch-all excuse borrowed from social science that never sees the problem as an active condition of neoliberalism and empire, but rather as a consequence of not enough neoliberalism and empire. In the media here, the United States is kind of a helpful bystander who wants or maybe even needs Mexico to get its act together, you know, so that they can share in the bounty of privatization and open markets. Can you tell us what the Merida initiative is or Plan Mexico and what role is that playing in current events in Mexico?
The Merida Initiative is a security aid package that has cost U.S. taxpayers now over $2.6 billion. It was designed as counter-narcotics, counter-terrorism, and border security, and it's been focused on what we know as the war on drugs. It's been in place for 8 years now. It was designed by President Bush as a three-year plan. At the end of those 3 years, the results were already disastrous. And yet, almost as soon as he came into office, the Obama administration extended the Merida initiative indefinitely. So the result of this, going after kingpins, hitting hard on some cartels, perhaps not so hard on others, has been a fragmentation of cartels, has been a huge explosion of violence. There are conflicts and turf battles taking place. There are, in some places, confrontations with security forces. There are security forces that are corrupted and are fighting with and between two different cartels. You know, it's really like taking the lid off the Pandora's box. So it's been a catastrophe of a public policy, and everybody knows it. So the second question is, then why did it continue? And if we look at it carefully, we see that under the Merida Initiative, there's no money allowed to go to Mexico. That means that all the contracting is done in the United States. There's a lot of defense contractors and private security companies that are very interested in continuing with this war on drugs, despite the results that it has for the people of Mexico and the cost to taxpayers in the United States.
The protests in Mexico don't look like quieting down anytime soon, do they?
No, the families are really frustrated. They believe that the government and the government has suspended the search for their children. They're demanding that they be searched for alive and not just in the morgues. They went to the army base that's nearby and demanded to search it because there's a hypothesis now that the students were not burned at the local dump by the drug cartels, but that their bodies were incinerated at the army base, because in terms of forensics, it seems to be impossible to have created those conditions of incineration just, you know, in a rainy day at a local dump. And they demanded to search the army base. The army base didn't let them in. There was a violent clash. So the tensions are getting higher and higher as they become more frustrated with the closed attitude and the increasingly evident cover-up on the part of the federal government.
We've been speaking with Laura Carlson of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. Find their work on the web at cipamericas.org. Laura Carlson, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
What Selma Gets Wrong was a big story at Politico, and that was days before the film's December release. Since then, there have been several volleys taken at the film, which depicts a key period in the fight over voting rights, and along with its African-American female director, Ava DuVernay, has been very powerfully received, particularly in black communities. So where are these criticisms coming from, and how should we understand them? Jim Narikas is the longtime editor of Fares magazine Extra. His recent piece on the movie Selma has appeared in These Times, among other places. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jim Narikas.
Thanks for having me on.
So who are some of the people making these criticisms of Selma, and what are they saying?
Well, it started out with some people closely associated with Lyndon Johnson, the director of the LBJ Presidential Library was upset because the film depicted the relationship between LBJ and Martin Luther King as contentious. And then Joseph Califano, who was a top domestic advisor to Johnson, said in the Washington Post that it falsely portrays Lyndon B. Johnson as being at odds with Martin Luther King. From there, it went on to a number of pundits who chimed in, taking this critique at face value. For example, Richard Cohen, a Washington Post columnist, denounced the film as a lie that tarnishes Johnson's legacy to exalt kings.
Richard Cohen, not known for his famous trumpeting of African-American rights. Well, it's not a documentary, to be clear. It's a fictional film, right? But still, what about this problem that it misrepresents the relationship between LBJ and Martin Luther King?
Well, the film does take some liberties with the chronology of things. But if you were to see the film and then to read these op-eds, you would get a more accurate depiction of history from the fictional film than from the supposedly factual op-eds. For example, the idea that the relationship between Johnson and King was not contentious and that King and Johnson were not at odds is belied by the actual tapes that were made by Johnson in the White House. There's one tape where he is talking to Bill Moyers, who was an aide as well, and Johnson says of King, he better get to behaving himself or all of them are going to be put in jail. Well, that sounds pretty contentious. And what he's upset about is the fact that there were sit-ins at the Justice Department and the White House protesting the fact that the federal government was not doing anything to protect marchers who were trying to go from Selma to Montgomery to protest the lack of voting rights. And you have to wonder if the relationship between Johnson and King was so harmonious, why are civil rights activists sitting in at the White House?
Hoover was his guy as well, right?
Right. Hoover was the chief of the FBI under Johnson, and Johnson reaffirmed his place there. In the film, Hoover is depicted as sending sex tapes to Coretta Scott King, King's wife, in an effort to discredit him. The critics have been very upset that the movie implies, but doesn't really say, that this was Johnson's idea. The actual historical record shows that when Hoover's FBI sent particularly incriminating tapes to the White House, they were seen by Johnson's top aide. This is Walter Jenkins, his closest aide for like 25 years. In a memo to Hoover from one of Hoover's aides, it says, Jenkins was of the opinion that the FBI could perform a good service to the country if this matter could somehow be confidentially given to members of the press. So the idea that Johnson was willing to use incriminating information about King against him, it's not made up by the filmmakers of Selma. It's part of the historical record.
Well, it isn't, in your view, just that these critics are getting the history of the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King wrong. You think they're getting the movie wrong in a way, too, that it's not about smearing Johnson really at all.
Yeah, I think that there's an expectation from Johnson's associates that this movie should be a celebration of Johnson with him as the hero of the civil rights movement. And by making the character of Johnson, he's not an unsympathetic character. He's not an opponent of civil rights. He's someone who is telling Martin Luther King that the time is not right just then for a Voting Rights Act, and that they ought to wait, which is actually what the historical Lyndon Johnson actually said to the historical Martin Luther King. He said, I'm going to do it eventually, but I can't get voting rights through in this session of Congress. And the movie is really the story of how King, through the civil rights movement, through demonstrating the nastiness of racist violence in the South, captured the national attention and convinced Lyndon Johnson that this was, in fact, the time to have a Voting Rights Act that would give blacks the political power that would enable them to get justice when they were subject to violence.
Well, and on that point, the film Selma was made before Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, before the whole Black Lives Matter movement. But it sort of feels like some people may be finding contention in any expression that doesn't pose white people essentially as the solution for black people's problems, you know, or that locates agency outside of traditional power sources. Do you think at all that that's some of that's going on?
I do. I feel like there's a real discomfort with the idea that the white, powerful, and notably liberal authority figure is not the moral center of the story, that he has something to learn from Martin Luther King, that Martin Luther King is showing him the urgency of doing something about racism and racist power. And at a time when there are African-Americans in the streets again calling on the people of America to do something about racist violence, it is striking how much hostility this film has gotten.
We've been speaking with Extra editor Jim Noricas. Find his piece on the movie Selma at fair.org. Thank you very much, Jim Noricas, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's fair.org. And the website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.